Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Ari Shah. I'm super excited to have with me today on the podcast, Steve-O here. Steve is the founder and CEO of O'Hare & Co., a strategic communications agency helping startups, scale-ups, and venture capital firms tell their story whilst reducing risk and increasing commercial success. Prior to founding O'Hare & Co., Steve spent over a decade as a tech journalist with TechCrunch. In today's episode, we talk about whether the quick commerce space is misunderstood.
Then I think the quick commerce space as a whole is definitely quite misunderstood, right? I think there's been this kind of misconception, partly driven by the way certain players in the space have, you know, positioned themselves, done a heavy amount of vouchering and discounting, has slightly distorted people's kind of viewpoint.
How you can attract customers who will pay for convenience, whether journalists move through the hype cycle, being bullish when startups are small but critical when they're bigger, and when a company is early, there are very few signals. So when an investor puts capital into a company, that's a signal where very few exist. Can you have too much press? When I see a founder suddenly doing lots and lots of press, I often almost find that a negative signal rather than a positive signal. Because it suggests to me they're kind of at the last chance scraping, kind of the like, okay, how do I get the name out there? How do I, you know, create some noise around the business because we've tried everything else? And the fact that intent matters. Let's get straight into it. This is Nothing Ventured with me, Ari Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode, and if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it. Steve, really wonderful to have you on the podcast with me. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Likewise.
Amazing. Let's get straight into it. So before we get started on anything else, I guess, I have often been a critic of quick commerce, but I'm self-aware enough to know that that was probably less a financial criticism than a pushback against ever-increasing consumerism. But with the recent withdrawal of Getir from the UK, Europe and the US announced about a week ago, it certainly looks like the industry is facing headwinds. And equally, speaking to an investor recently who has backed a quick commerce venture in South Asia, he's extremely bullish because in those markets, there's a population density that makes sense and the unit economics are much better given low delivery costs. So can you give me your take on the quick commerce gold rush, given your time at Zap, and what do you think the right strategy is for the remaining players?
Yeah, no, for sure. So I think I'd preface this with saying that I think the quick commerce space as a whole is definitely quite misunderstood, right? I think there's been this kind of misconception, partly driven by the way certain players in the space have, you know, positioned themselves, done a heavy amount of vouchering and discounting, has slightly distorted people's kind of viewpoint. And the misconception is this: the quick commerce model can definitely work, but it's not trying to replace the planned ahead grocery shop, right? And you often hear people describe these apps as speedy grocery, right? But at Zap, we were always very, very clear. We were in the convenience retail space, right? What do I mean by that? I mean purchases you're going to make when spontaneous purchases or urgent need purchases, very much like walking down to your convenience store, right? Convenience retail is worth, you know, something like £45 billion in the UK alone. I think over half of that is in London. And just to sort of let people conceptualize what that means, I think an average supermarket stocks something like, I think maybe 30,000 stews. And Zap, we stock 3,000 stews, right? And those stews are tailored towards I need it now.
Yeah.
I need it. Snacks, drinks, snacks. Yes, of course, some f other food items. Also great products that don't fit the food category. So
Yeah.
we sell out beauty products, pharmaceuticals, over-the-counter stuff. And then to your point about the sort of unit economics, you have to attract the right customers that are willing to pay for convenience, and they're less price sensitive. So they accept that to have ultra convenience means that you're not competing purely on price. And I think that's what set our strategy apart from some of the other players in the space, is accepting that this is a premium product, and you have to serve the right use cases, those convenience use cases, and have the products that have margins to support that and help absorb some of the delivery costs. So I think that's the misconception. We were never trying to replace the planned ahead grocery shop. What we were doing is providing classic convenience retail that has been really slow to move online and be digitized in the way that other commerce categories have gone to e-commerce. And as I've always said, and I said this 3 years ago when I joined Zap, convenience always wins, and especially online, right?
Well,
So to
it's
me,
how Amazon have built the behemoth that they've
right,
built.
exactly. And it's no coincidence that there's our one of our founders at Zap is ex-Amazon, right? So if convenience always wins, and convenience is amplified when it moves online, and convenience retail has been quite slow in making that transition, to me, the model still works. I don't think it's particularly controversial or contrarian to say that people are willing to pay a little bit more to have ultra convenience. And we're seeing that at Zap, and that's borne out in our unit economics. We're profitable on an operational level. So in other words, our store networks are profitable minus central costs, and we're moving over time to a really clear path to profitability. But as I say, we were always clear. We're in the convenience retail business. We're not trying to replace the planned ahead big weekly shop.
Yeah, so there's a few things that come out of that, and not to kind of necessarily go into too much detail, but the first point is, and I think you mentioned it, juiced up on venture capital, a lot of the other players were basically using heavy discounting, vouchering. So they're essentially using VC money to pay for your goods, right? Like that was what attracted a lot of people to using some of those services. But the minute that sort of venture capital juice sort of slowed down or stopped altogether, it moved from, okay, well, this is no longer essentially a cheaper option for me, so I'm gonna go back to kind of the convenience store, the grocery supermarket, or whatever. And to your point, you've got to find the people that want to pay for the convenience. It price should not be the factor. Price should not be the de
Yeah,
deciding factor,
absolutely.
right?
You don't want to compete on price when you're selling convenience over price sensitivity. That doesn't mean you have to be like outlandishly expensive, but you also have to. But you also need to focus on some differentiation, right? So I think where Zap has particularly been successful is that we work with some amazing boutique and premium brands alongside what we call everyday essentials,
Yeah.
right? In other words, there's stuff at Zap that you won't find anywhere else. You won't be able to walk down to the local convenience store and pick up some of the products that we sell because we've worked really, really hard. In fact, we recently did a sort of brand refresh to kind of align our brand identity with that more premium positioning. And even that, we've seen success that more and more brands want to work with us, where they wouldn't necessarily want to work with other platforms. So, that's been our strategy. Premium product differentiation and not overly discounting to attract the wrong customers.
I mean, to be honest, that's a strategy that you could apply to many, many businesses and apply it very well. I think, you know, as a CFO, that those are often the sort of things that we're looking for as well, right? Can you charge a premium price? How do you differentiate the product rather than competing solely on price? And, you know, how do you find the right customer that's going to repeat again and again? Because those are the things that they value. Moving on from Zap, Michael Moritz, former partner at Sequoia, was famously a journalist for many, many years prior to joining the storied firm. I'm really interested in the intersection of journalism and venture, having written three articles myself as of today, and how they influence each other, often overtly cheerleading and at other times completely doom-laden in their take. And we see a lot of that, I think, in the US, maybe more so than the UK, Europe. But from your time at TechCrunch, do you think there is a healthy relationship between the two industries? And how do you actually see the interplay between them?
Yeah, no, for sure. I think there's this sort of stereotype. I think one of the big US VC firms talked about the kind of hype cycle. But there's this sort of stereotype that journalists are all sort of super bullish on startups when they're small. And then when they get bigger at some point, you know, it's like then people want to have a pop at them and trying to knock them down, right? And whilst I think that there is some correlation that when some of these tech companies get really big, that they're held to more scrutiny. And obviously the ethos of journalism is this idea that you're holding power to account, right? So I don't think there's anything kind of malicious going on when companies that become more, have a bigger influence on society, are held to greater account. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think some of the criticism of journalism is a bit misguided because people don't want to be held to account and they don't want that scrutiny. So I think we do see some of that. But I think what's really interesting about particularly trade journalism and business journalism and the VC industry is, to some extent, VCs are investing in stories.
Yeah.
Right? So the storytelling aspect of startups, scale-ups, is to me is hugely significant. And when companies do PR and try to gain media coverage, one of the things that I advise founders is really figure out, like, what are the business goals you're laddering up to? And PR for the sake of it of itself is like stupid. Right? Always figure out what, you know, we want to create some media coverage, but what are the needles we're trying to move? Right? And of course, the reality is when you're in the venture-backed business, you are partly talking to current and future investors.
Yeah.
So in other words, the kind of the relationship between storytelling and therefore comms and raising, or at least ensuring your existing investors follow on, is quite intertwined. And that is, you know, that is the reality. Whether it's healthy at times or not is probably beyond, you know, my pay grade, right? But at the end of the day, that is a reality. Yeah. VCs invest in stories, and that relationship it exists because, as you will know, like, when you build a business that's venture-backed, it has different kind of rules to a business that isn't trying to reach the scale that a VC-backed company is.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things there. So firstly, I love the fact that you touched on that sort of storytelling aspect. I mean, I'm, you know, a huge proponent of narrative over numbers, I think, in some senses as a CFO, but obviously the numbers have to make sense as well. It feels like what you're talking about there is almost like a perpetual pitch, right? Like the purpose of PR for a startup is to get your story out there, get your narrative out there, and to your point, attract both customers, potential customers, community, but also investors, right? Create some FOMO, create that kind of you know, desire to be part of that story. And I think, you know, for me, I think where I started getting maybe jaded is the wrong word, but I think I switched off a little bit when, you know, when you're constantly bombarded with the, you know, XYZ business has raised, you know, 100 million at a 500 million valuation, whatever the numbers would be, obviously probably wouldn't be quite as low as that, but, you know, 100 million at a billion valuation. And you're seeing that kind of almost on a weekly, monthly basis. I started to feel like, well, hold on, what is being reported on here? Because yes, it is a positive thing that those businesses got funded, but the funding isn't the business. And I think that's the bit that felt disconnected for me, was that there was a lot of journalism, there's a lot of stories around the fundraising event, but actually not about the business itself, or that maybe that narrative was lost a little bit under that headline of, you know, raise a huge amount at a huge valuation. Would you agree with that, or is that just me being like remarkably sensitive to the whole thing?
I think the way I used to think about it when I was a journalist is I would often get asked, Steve, why do you cover so many funding rounds? Right now, I used to cover a lot of really early stage. So not even pre-seed, but definitely seed in the Series A. And my argument there was pretty simple, right? When a company's that early, there are very few signals, right? And when I mean signals, I mean things that can indicate the company has a chance of success, that they're in an interesting space, both from a sort of value capture point of view, but also just interesting in terms of solving real problems, right? So when investors are attached, they've actually put their money where their mouth is. Like, that is a signal where very few signals exist. So I think the reason for covering early stage rounds is obviously in partly, you know, places like TechCrunch are kind of, you know, sifted like the site of record for the industry, that they're essentially their trade publications, right? So their job is to kind of be the site of record. But also in terms of why should I care about this company over this other company? Well, like I said, well, there's very few signals, right? They haven't got much traction, et cetera, et cetera. Then obviously in a funding round means they've gone through some kind of due diligence in the general sense of the word. So that's why it's to cover so much early stage. Plus, it was a great way of building relationships with founders. And I think... you know, I was very lucky to cover companies super early that went on, you know, all the way to IPO in some instances, and always maintained that relationship. So selfishly, it was also a good way of building sources and then kind of elevating my own work. With your point about like much bigger rounds, I mean, I understand your point. There's too much emphasis put on money raised versus actually digging into like the probably more relevant numbers. But I mean, I think it would also be irresponsible not to cover the kind of bubble that we saw and highlighting some of these crazy valuations. And we've seen some of those completely crash and burn, right? But I think your sentiment is sort of correct. There's probably too much emphasis on money raised versus some of the hard graft of actually building a business. And that's a fair point.
Yeah, no, look, I mean, I have to probably cop to the same sort of attitude myself, right? In the sense that this podcast is not a journalistic podcast. You know, I ask questions, I occasionally ask hard questions, but the guests that come on here aren't coming on here to be grilled, right? And probably wouldn't be very happy if they were, right? So when you are in the business of building relationships, and I certainly am, and it sounds like obviously whether as a journalist or indeed, you know, in your current kind of role within PR, it is all about relationships, right? So the bridges that you burn are bridges that, you know, are going to cost you in the future. So I think you have to walk that balance. Now, there are obviously journalists that take the hypercritical view, you know, and they aren't much like, certainly on, you know, Twitter or X. But equally, and I think this is, you know, the happy ground is that, to your point, those events, those signals are still events and are still signals. They still are worthy of being reported on. If the balance skews a bit too much towards that, then that's probably just, you know, that's just probably the nature of, to your point, the fact that there are very few signals, right? So ultimately, I think what you're saying is that unintentionally, or not, I mean, that's not even the right word, I would think, but, you know, journalism almost walks hand in hand, I guess, with venture capital in that sense, right? It is part of the VC machine, because the reality is that both founders as well as VCs want to be recognized for being part of that next big thing. And that narrative and that storytelling has to happen in a way that is almost natural and is newsworthy. And speaking of newsworthy, and I guess this is kind of just a side question, because you mentioned, you know, in the intro, you know, one of the first, or you reported, or you're the first to report on Wave, for example, which has just, you know, raised $1 billion, a UK born company. I mean, when did you first write about them, and you know, what does it feel like sort of seeing where they've come to from where you first came across them?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I can't remember the exact date, but I do remember the pitch was it's going to sound so common sense now. But the pitch was basically, look, a lot of the companies trying to solve the autonomous driving problem are basically throwing more and more sensors at cars and trying to capture more data. And that actually the way that they believed they were going to solve the problem was through better machine learning. And what they meant was, rather than kind of teaching a car, here's all the rules, and then when the car sees something it's never seen before, it's going to crash, right? And so they were saying that approach works well on very predictable sort of grid streets like in San Francisco, but isn't going to work in places in the real world where the car isn't going to be able to have a perfect map up front. And so their answer was machine learning. Now, given the explosion in kind of LLMs and the advancements in neural networks that we see today, I think around, you know, the Google Transformer technology, and I don't profess to be an expert, but the point is, it's very uncontroversial in 2024 to say that machine learning, self-learning, will solve the autonomous driving problem. Seems like, well, yeah, duh. What other responsibility would you take? But that was their pitch back then. And it was always pitched against, this is a different approach to the one being taken by big tech, right? Now, great pitch, because that was like enough for me to think, all right, sure. Like, whether I believe it or not is a different matter. This is a tiny company, I think, coming out of Cambridge. And I thought, well, some guys in the UK are not going to, you know, a small, tiny team, are not necessarily going to solve this ahead of big tech. But yeah, like you say, they raised a huge round yesterday and they seem to be making great traction. But yeah, I mean, I used to cover a lot of companies super early. And the reason why I look quite smart to this day isn't because I had some crazy insight or that I'm particularly great at that stuff. It was just more that I took a very agnostic approach, right? It goes back to our earlier point about VC. If there was enough signals and I thought the problem space existed, then I would give it a fair hearing. And for me, you know, the market decides.
Yeah,
it's not for a journalist sitting in a bedroom in Tottenham, North London, to try and make, you know, wild predictions. It's my job to ask the right questions and to do a level of scrutiny that lets the reader go away and learn something. And then, A, they make up their mind. But in the end, the market decides, right? And there's so many moving parts that I think, you didn't ask this, but people overestimate the effect of media coverage in terms of defining success or failure. Okay, it can help. It's a really important way of aligning customers, employees, future investors, current investors, the public sentiment in general. Like, these are all really important things to get right. But does it define the end ultimate, like, Boolean, you know, one or zero, succeed or failure? Of course it doesn't.
I think on that point very specifically, and this is based on pure gut, but my feeling has always been when I see a founder suddenly doing lots and lots of press, I often almost find that a negative signal rather than a positive signal. because it suggests to me they're kind of at the last chance scraping, kind of the like, okay, how do I get the name out there? How do I, you know, create some noise around the business because we've tried everything else. Now that isn't always the case for sure, yep. But I do get the impression that, you know, there is a balance to be struck, right? Like, so you.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard people say that before. I actually don't think that's true. I think, you know, a really good example is Tom Brumfield at Monzo.
Yeah.
Right. He did a lot of press in the first few years. I used to joke with him, you know, that he spent at least half his time talking to journalists. But his messaging was so good, right? Whether we believe it or not, he was going to build a 10x better bank, right? And it was going to be, you know, much more like aligned with the actual customer in terms of misaligned incentives in banking. He was able to articulate that story and that message. And I know some of the key employees at Monzo, like after, say, a couple of years, I know some of those people joined Monzo because they read about Monzo in the press, right? And they bought into that mission. Obviously, their customer growth was amazing. Now, I'm not a cheerleader for Monzo. I probably caused them more pain and difficulties in my time in journalism than upside. But the point is, he definitely got a lot of press and probably could fall into the bucket that you just described. Mm. But his messaging was great, and he was really good with the media. And that level of engagement, I think, played out and probably helped the company during some of its more difficult times when the pandemic struck, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's an oversimplification to say too much PR necessarily is a negative signal. However, it can't be a vanity project, and it can't mask not actually solving the fundamentals of a business. What it can do is, like I said, align the various stakeholders. It can help with customer acquisition, but only if the company through the press is talking to its end customers. And a lot of press you do has nothing to do with end customers, right?
Yeah.
If you're going to get on TechCrunch, like, you're not going to pick up many customers unless you're in a space relevant to the readers of TechCrunch. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I think customer acquisition is not always the top goal of PR, because that's very top of the funnel. Mm. There's probably other better ways to reach end customers. I think it's much more about attracting future employees. It's about aligning other stakeholders, potentially even like regulators, the public sentiment in general, future investors we spoke about. Customers are only one of those segments. And it goes back to what I said earlier. The biggest lesson for founders is make sure your marketing teams or your in-house or your agencies really like explain how this particular campaign or this particular approach to PR is actually going to ladder up.
Yeah.
And has either a dotted line or a hard line to business goals. And I think when you run it all through that lens, like, you know, that's what makes great comps. And so going back to my Monzo example, yeah, Tom was really clear with the message. He knew exactly who he was speaking to and why he was doing it.
I'm more than happy to be challenged and corrected on that. And yes, look, I mean, I guess to your point, audience matters incredibly, the message matters incredibly. But I mean, look, you've talked on touched on some of these points already, but to talk about Ohere & Co., I'd love to understand from your perspective, what does a comm strategy look like for a VC-backed startup? What's the value of it? And especially as it often feels like many VCs themselves don't necessarily have one, because you do comms and strategy, I guess, for comms and PR for both startups as well as VC firms. So yeah, just talk me through kind of, you know, watch and appreciating that obviously every business is different and every, you know, every strategy will need to be tweaked, but give us some sort of basics that startups and VCs maybe should be thinking about.
You know, for sure. So if we take startups first, I think one of the things we always try to figure out with the founders and their teams is, are they at day zero in terms of the media's understanding of what is the problem they're solving and how they solve it? And then by extension, obviously, their customers and users. But don't forget, when you're doing PR, you're talking through the media, right? So your first stakeholder is the journalist themselves, when you think about it, like they're going to carry your message. So trying to figure out, like, are they at day zero or day 0.5, right? And what you find is a lot of the teams, they're so close to the problem that they presume far too much prior knowledge. So one of our jobs is to work out a plan that explains what they do in a very simple, clear terms, and recognizes with some real honesty, like how far behind or ahead they are. Right. So that's one thing, kind of aligning on where they're at in terms of their sort of recognizable brand problem space amongst the media. And that's a bit of an ego check, right? Because, you have to remind people that no one knows who you are, no one cares.
No one cares.
Okay. And then you need to like start doing stuff. Start like, obviously a funding announcement is something we understand and are really good at, because I wrote literally thousands of funding stories for TechCrunch. And so that's a nice hard news moment to generate some publicity and start to explain the problem space and how you solve it. And then the challenge comes after that is, once that hard news is gone, do you have any amazing product announcements coming up? Is there any really, really interesting hires? Are you doing any M&A? So you're looking at like other hard news moments. And that's probably the biggest challenge for a non-consumer facing company, is you're very limited with hard news moments. And then you have to go into like being a bit more creative and smart around kind of evergreen pitching. So what we're finding, over here in Co is, like, if you have a great story, then there's a lot of mileage in essentially packaging up the same evergreen pitch, which goes back to my point, because these companies are at day zero, right? So I think people often forget that the long-term evergreen pitching is a strategy in itself, because there isn't going to be a tremendous amount of hard news, right? So that's one thing. Like, and the way I frame it to my own team and the founders, I think you can break PR down into three things. And it's kind of a Venn diagram, right? There's story, there's relationships, as in your relationships with the media, and then there's execution, as in like just basic process stuff, like don't pitch, on a bank holiday. Sounds dumb, right? Or like, make sure you give your target publication enough of a heads up and the right kind of heads up to make their job really easy. Make sure the press release is fantastically written. So again, you're lowering the amount of brain work and time it takes for a journalist to want to pick it up. So you're making their life easier. So story, relationship, and execution. And I'm going to give you a test. If you had to choose only one of those three, which one would you take?
I'm really conflicted. I'm leaning towards execution.
Okay, that's interesting. Most people say relationships, right?
Maybe that's part. Yeah, I guess I find relationships easy, so maybe that's why. I don't know, but yeah, I was and I'm thinking about, when I started, I say started. The few articles that I wrote for the Evening Standard came out of a relationship that I built with, the business and tech lead. And I just pitched him and said, you know what, look, I'd love to write, can I write? And he's like, yeah, great. And then I wrote, and to your point, like, the writing was good, but it wasn't it, there was definitely some things that he would have tweaked and edited and changed. But I started thinking then, okay, how can I make sure that this article or the next article definitely won't have to go through changes? How can I make it better? How can I write it better? So it wasn't necessarily about the story, it was about the execution from that perspective. But I also understand why a lot of people would lean towards relationships, for sure.
Right. So the answer is story, right?
Yeah, okay,
And I'll
fine.
tell you what, if you're a startup or a startup and you've got an amazing story and you figured out like what the story is, story trumps both those other two things. You can cold pitch a journalist with a great story. Yeah.
I head
You
faked
can
myself
even,
out of that answer, I've got to be honest. Okay,
you can
fine.
even mess up the execution.
Yeah.
You can give a journalist too little time or badly written press release.
But if the story is
Story
bloody
trumps
amazing,
everything.
yeah,
Now,
fine.
obviously, at O'Hare & Co., we work really hard to have the sweet spot where it overlaps. So, we try to find the great story. We obviously have some amazing relationships. And when I say relationships, I don't mean no journalist is going to cover a rubbish story just because they know us. Relationship just means your pitch will get read and heard. And maybe you can, like, the journalist went off to again make their work smoother, right? No one wants to work with a painful set of comms professionals. And then execution is just knowing, like, we have great muscle memory about how to write clear messaging, a great press release, package it up in the right way, have the right amount of lead time. Because obviously, if you offer a story with too much lead time, no one's going to make a decision about what they're going to do in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah.
But if you give a story so short notice, a journalist just won't cover it because, frankly, they don't have the time. So, yeah, of course, you need all three, but story trumps everything. And by the way, as an aside, every agency over eggs their relationships, right? When I was a journalist, any PR that had pitched me, if they got a yes or no, would probably be then claiming
They had
they had
a
a relationship with
strong
tech company.
relationship. Yeah.
Yeah. So story trumps everything. And our job is to find the story.
Yeah. I, again, as I said earlier, as the CFO that talks about narrative over numbers, I kind of feel a bit gutted that I didn't say story. I was like, literally, no, story's the obvious one, but actually, maybe it's execution. So I think I was trying to be a bit too clever there. No, I mean, look, that makes, I obviously, it makes a huge amount of sense. I think, to your point, I think a lot of startups suffer from that. Well, I've got nothing to say, kind of that, you know, that's part of the problem. But you can find things to say. You've just got to figure out how to say them. I think the other problem is that, and to your point, I had this conversation actually very recently with some investors that I know that are kind of, you know, they're not raising quite a fund, but they're, you know, they just got FCA regulated, et cetera. And he was saying, okay, how do we get this in the press? How do I get into the FT? And I'm like, but why? Why would the FT pick this up? I mean, like, it's, you know, it's great as in it's bloody amazing what you're doing, and I get it because I know you guys. But realistically, is this press, right? Like, is this something that goes out, and is there a story behind it? And any he sort of WhatsApped me the next day. He goes, "Look, thanks for bringing me back to earth a little bit. You know, no one wants to hear about, you know, about this thing that we're doing." I'm like, "No, it's not. But you've got to have a story that sells it. Like, why does this differentiate you from the other VC funds that are raising or doing whatever they're doing, right?"
No, I mean, yeah, the really interesting thing there is I spend a lot of time with VCs, and we have a couple of great VC clients, and I'm really honest when we've taken on those retainers. Is that there's very little differentiation in VC. If you look at the story telling or the narrative, most VCs say exactly the same thing.
We close fund one, we invest in exceptional founders, you
Yeah,
know.
we're founder friendly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all the usual stuff, right? So it's very hard to differentiate. And what's amazing with the clients we work with in venture is the ones where it's worked really well. Is they allow us to spend quite a lot of their time supporting their portfolio companies. And the reason why it's a great strategy is, at the end of the day, why does a VC need PR? Right? As far as I can figure out, it's two reasons. Attract future LPs, and it's not increased deal flow. It's nonsense. All the best VCs have plenty of deal flow. What they need is optionality. They need to be seeing the best deals, but the crucial bit is they need to have the option to invest in the best deals. So the reason why their storytelling is important is to signal to founders, take my money over taking,
Yeah. So
sales money,
yeah. So
whatever, right?
I would have bucketed that with deal flow, but I get the nuance for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, so what better way to hit those two notes than to routinely have their portfolio companies in the media.
Yeah, 100%. And that, yeah, so my point would have been 100% agree, you know, they need to attract future LPs or equally keep their existing LPs kind of happy, you know, okay, yeah, okay, they've just come in the press and that's great. And these guys have raised this and, you know, and that portfolio company is doing well. But the second thing is, you know, in a very competitive market, and it has been very competitive for a number of years, and we've seen this certainly in the 21, 22, and you had Tiger Global and SoftBank obviously mussing their way into lots of stuff. You know, I think founders don't often appreciate the fact that VCs are fighting for allocation in deals as much as founders are fighting to raise those funds in the first place, right? And because the hot deals get snapped up really, really quickly. Yep. So it's why would you take my money over someone else's when I know this big name brand and they've done this and they've done that? Whereas, okay, you're a smaller firm. I haven't really heard of you. Okay, what makes you different? Now, if you've got a narrative that can prove that, yeah, actually we are different and this is what we can point to that shows that we're different, it's going to be that much easier for a founder, not necessarily a given, but it's going to be easier for a founder to make that decision than if they know nothing about you whatsoever.
Yeah, of course. And one way to do that is if a founder tells another founder, these VCs were really good at making amazing introductions. And by the way, they have great comms advice that then filters through to them, right?
Yeah.
So there's like you're hitting several things when you get PR for your portfolio company. It's obviously what you said. The LPs probably really liked it. Obviously, every headline that says so-and-so startup raises X led by Y, like it's really crucial. But I also just think word of mouth is like, think about it, over the last 10 years, I think, in Europe, every VC started to wax lyrical that they offer operational support.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And one of those areas is comms.
Yeah.
And so when a VC hires us, by extension, they have a great comms partner that can also be either directly or indirectly supporting their portfolio. So in a sense, we become an extension of their own operational support.
Yeah, no, I mean, that whole kind of venture partner, operating partner model, platform model, we see it with Atomico, you see it with obviously Andreessen Horowitz being the absolutely famous one. You know, it is really important to founders, especially in a world where there are also lots and lots of, let's face it, I wouldn't say charlatans, but there are lots of people out there that are selling services where they're not necessarily the right people or the best people to be doing it. And I think, again, and I'm sure you see this, we certainly see this, like the clients that we are most likely to kind of work with are the ones where we've been introduced directly from their VCs. And the reason for that is they trust their VCs, the VCs trust us. Therefore, there is this sort of trust triangle that's happening there, which just makes it a lot easier for a founder to make that decision. But Steve, look, one sort of final question before we get to the final question. You've never met your team in person, including your co-founder, Rachel. So what is your take on this constant debate, certainly on Twitter and in the press, around this issue? And what does it mean more broadly, do you think, for social mobility?
You know, for sure. So where I've landed on the work from home versus office debate is, I think, hybrid is probably the best approach for some companies.
Definitely not contentious.
And I think in office is right for very operational heavy companies. So Zap, for example, is office first. I think that broadly makes sense. For me personally, because of my disability and kind of COVID, you know, which people think has completely disappeared, which is obviously not true, and other sort of respiratory illnesses, so even like a really bad flu will be quite bad for me. It just means I'm still working from home, but that's always worked well for me. Even from, like, you know, when I first entered the workforce, I was working from home. I was one of those people that did that way before it became a thing, and I've always had an exceptional ability to build genuine relationships remotely. I mean, you saw that in my journalists and careers you and I have never met. This is not an unusual occurrence. But yeah, I think hybrid for some companies is probably the sweet spot because people don't want to do the commute every single day necessarily. And sometimes focus time is really useful. I mean, you have to be very careful about back-to-back Zoom meetings. It's too easy to have a meeting when you're remote and so forth. But yeah, that's where I've landed. And in terms of O'Hare & Co., yeah, I mean, I've met our chair sort of co-founder, which is the founder of SAP. Obviously, I've met Naveed a few times. But yeah, I've never met my co-founder, O'Hare & Co., yet we worked intensely together at Zap, and we continue to this day, and I'm sure we will meet maybe this summer. But yeah, it's proof that, and your point about social mobility, at the end of the day, without the internet, without being able to work remotely, my career would have been completely stifled, right? So I think what I like about my own example is when you have a bit of imagination and you let go a bit of sort of conventional thinking, amazing things can happen, right? And even when I left TechCrunch to join Zap, it was all because the founders of Zap, I was like, hey, like, I need to work from home, da da da. And they were just like, tell us what you need and we'll make it work. And I think that's the romanticism in me. Just like people should imagine more and should have a more of like kind of lateral thinking and can do, and some amazing things can happen.
I think that's such a wonderful sentiment. It's very much the, it's the make lemons out of lemonade, not to be dismissive or negative, but I mean, like, I think a lot of people focus on the what they can't do rather than what they can do. And if you can figure out a way of doing what you can do in the best possible situation and way for yourself, like, that's amazing. I mean, for you, clearly, and I don't know kind of how much your disability kind of impacts your life. I'm assuming very heavily, just from what little I know of you and having spoken to you. But, the fact that you've had a 10-year career at TechCrunch, senior vice president, is that, like, clearly your disability has not been a barrier to you getting into
No,
those
that's
roles. But it
yeah.
may have made it more difficult, but it hasn't been a
No, I mean,
barrier.
it means, I have to juggle things in a way that someone who's able-bodied doesn't have to. But I think the point about my journey to Zap is they threw me in at a very high level, right? And they focused on what to go right, not to go wrong. And Naveed, the founder of Zap, saw something in me that a lot of other people missed, right? And then offered me the flexibility. The pandemic, in a weird way, helped because people were more open to that at the
Well, they
time.
understood it.
Yeah, so it opened up a whole new array of opportunities for me. I had other job offers. And the conversation about can I work from home temporarily went away. And that enabled that social mobility. And my point about wonderful things can happen is, like, being really honest, there wasn't like, you would think if I was leaving TechCrunch, there'd be hundreds of job offers, and there just wasn't. Maybe that says more about my ego, but since then, joining Zap, I've done all right there. Trust me, I'm still there, still supporting the company. So obviously, that was clearly a good thing. And then, to your point, I've now gone on and founded what looks like a really promising business with Rachel, who I've never met in person.
Well, look, I mean, I look forward to supporting you through that journey as well. So I have one final question. What is the one thing that you have an intensely contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially, or at home? What is that hill that you would die on defending?
It's a really good question. I want to just start by saying I don't think the world needs any more sort of faux contrarianism, right?
Yeah, I can't
I
think of an
think
answer to this question, by the way. So,
contrarianism is often an excuse for being pretty dumb, and often that, things worse than that, right? Misogyny and racism and so forth. That said, if I had to pick something, weirdly, I think what it is, I think intent really matters. And I think a lot in the sort of some of the sort of Twitter spats and kind of the culture wars
Yeah.
and stuff, there's just, I think we've lost something very human, which is that intent matters, and that people often make mistakes in public. They say bad things that they should probably obviously educate themselves. It's not an excuse for being ignorant, but I think sometimes we lose intent, right? And someone's intention, I think, still means something, regardless of the outcome. And so, yeah, I think that's something I'm passionate about. It's not always popular, but I think we in some of these very kind of these debates, like the human element of intent, like gets lost.
Yeah.
And I, as a journalist, that was often my filter. Like I would report on stuff that went wrong, I would hold people to account, but I never lost the sense of right intent does
Yeah.
matter.
Were they doing it purposefully, or was it
Yeah,
circumstances that led them down?
misguided. Yeah, and where was their intent? Because in the end, like, what separates us? What is our value system? It's that influences our intentions, and I'd rather hold people to account on their values than necessarily the outcomes.
I think that is a wonderful note on which to end the podcast. Steve, thank you so much for joining me. For our audience, where is the best place for them to find you online? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you on Twitter? Where can they find you on the interweb?
Sure, on Twitter I'm SO here, SOHEAR. Or you can find my company oheaco.com. So oheaco.com or ohere.net is my personal domain.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure.